actually, no, I was in Dawson City briefly, and I walked through the alley where the whorehouses were. And they were like, there was a board across a muddy swamp, and the women would come out of these little shacks and stand in their door with their dogs. Oh. It was really wild. I'm so honored to be behind the first door. Really. I never thought I really wanted to be in a whorehouse, but I like this. I love Trick House. Thank you for Trick House. God bless Basho, because he's able to capture a world in 17 syllables. My last attempts at haiku never clock in under 6,000 words, which is usually a sign that you should be killed. So that I don't earn his ire, I have taken some fragments from a braided essay, because I'm really interested in pushing nonfiction in a kind of magical direction, and I do so with fragments, but I thought for your sake I'd give you something whole. So I've taken fragments and sort of woven them together here, and it's vastly shorter than 6,000 words. This will go fast. I've been spending the last 4 years writing North American landscapes, and this is one of those landscapes, and it's essentially an East Coast landscape. And this is nonfiction. In a place he names Arcadia. It is mid-March, and still winter prevails. I am walking in a storm at night. What horizon there was vanishes in a swirl of snow. My feet slip sideways with every step. I am not so much walking as falling repeatedly. I am an ant scrambling in the throat of a peony, lost in folds of white, only to find more whiteness unfurling. I wade through meadows drifting into the shape of the ocean, dense swells and windless straits. Dissolving in a fizz, I imagine I am a traveler who wandered off the trail into a 10,000-year burial. They will thaw me at the end of the next ice age and search my pockets for clues as to who I was. Cold proves a perfect form of protection, for these are the specifics that survive. Keys to locks long lost, to entrances unimaginable. A lipstick, good for drawing on walls. A tampon, good for packing wounds. A pen, good for prying, for poking holes. A miniature box of fire chief matches. There is a shrunken American flag on the cover, just above an emblem of fire. In the section representing the states, there are only 3 stars. A fistful of nickels, pennies, dimes, good for ballast and for worry. A nugget of chocolate in the shape of a heart, an edible icon of the engine of the body. Jeans, sweater, socks, boots, hat, coat, the seemingly ceremonial underwear and bra, all stamped with the same word. She wears not clothes, but China. Graffiti on the body, on arms, torso, groin, are marks tribal and medicinal, teeth full of metal. Within the heart, still is a stone. Within the heart, if they look, 7 notches signifying nothing known. Who was she, this woman found buried in the snow? She was a lost fool with poor wilderness skills who died wandering in the storm. Prop her body in an air-controlled unit of the museum so people can pay to glimpse a plain example of a person from a distant era. They will guess who she was, and they will fail. Archaeology is poetry, all history, a kind of waking dream, as much the story of the dreamer as anything. Bits of lives lived, assembled in boxes at the flea market, in the basement of the museum, wait to be dreamt back into story. Each teller takes a fragment of an old tale and makes it anew again, blending corrections with lies, imagining omissions into specificity. My father trundled us into the car, our belongings traveling behind us in the yellow and green Mayflower van. This, many centuries after our ancestors embarked for the New World on a ship of the same name. The story of the species has always had at its center people moving, pilgrims and slaves and refugees, some fleeing, some seeking, some torn away, all of them dreaming of food, water, shelter, the absence of war. This time, our patriarch gambled on Maryland, where we are able to settle for the remarkably long span of 6 years. The land that is the state has had many names before this one given by the English, most of which were lost with the namers, It will undoubtedly one day have a new name later, after changes in the world I do not wish to imagine. The first Europeans arrived long before my family in 1524, an Italian, Giovanni de Verrazzano, and the French ship Dauphine, entered the mouth of the Pocomoke and makes land there, just a few miles from where my family will one day live. Overwhelmed by the beauty of the trees after months at sea, he writes in his journal that he names the place Arcadia. A young man from a local tribe stands on shore holding a torch, witnessing the arrival of the Europeans. Verrazzano, suffering from the racial narcissism of all explorers, remarks upon the boy's long black hair, the olive tone of his skin. He tells us, too, that the torchbearer keeps himself at a distance and that when he gestures toward the sky with the flame as if to offer us fire, the sailors choose to interpret this as a threat, and they begin shouting at him and shooting at him. The boy bolts into the trees, and they chase him. In their pursuit, they come upon three women carrying children in baskets on their backs. They seize a boy from the youngest of the women, and then they attempt to take her, too, but she is tall and has a scream that intimidates. She will save herself by failing to rescue the child. By the time my family arrives in this landscape, 450 years later, the way for our presence has been temporarily cleared, but the land is soaked with the blood of natives and settlers and slaves. Such is the history of all the Earth's inhabited spaces. There is no place where this is not the case. We made a home then on acres washed flat by ocean, in a land geologists say is sinking yet again. I'm 10 years old. The house across the field from ours was the color of dusty milk. Crooked, afloat on acres, treeless and almost always green, it seemed half ship, half house, elusive, like you could walk for days toward it and it would remain just out of reach, pulled by currents you could never see. At sunset, sometimes the windows would blister, cracked by light. More than once, I will pass at that hour and worry that the house is burning, that it is too late for the family inside. I will imagine that only I can hear them, and that they will come fancy dancing into the field, their bodies wreathed in a fate that cannot escape. And then the bus would pull away, leaving me standing there in December cold, open-mouthed, guilty of imagining the neighbor's immolation. I am too young then to be shocked by the pleasure this brings. I turn and walk down the drive past the gray garden, past the gray pear tree toward our 100-year-old house. I stand beneath the 200-year-old oak that grows too close to the foundation and stare up at the windowed back door, wondering if they simply could not have imagined what the tree would become one day, like the day I stood there considering the choices of builders, strangers, many generations before. I know these things are real. The house, the tree, the door, the girl imagining the family inside, all of them being tugged by time into new forms, the tree swelling, the house tilting, the children fleeing, the nerves inside the girl's heart drawing too much energy through the salted tide of her blood. I imagine that everything that has ever happened to me in this life is always happening somewhere in the origami of the brain. The sensory floating through the fog of self, climbing for the sake of story on the back of the names we gave the things of the world. And so I am a woman writing her way to the end of this winter in the first decade of a new century. At the same time, I am a girl standing outside of the house, hesitating before heading into dinner. Somewhere locked in the indigo light of dusk outside my childhood home, a young woman is screaming at sailors, at the Christ-loving barbarians who have stolen a boy from her care. Somewhere in the darkness of a cargo hold, a boy is listening to a mouth make strange sounds he knows are human, but foreign. The words circling his ears, soft as moths, will enter him eventually, though this will take a long time. I'm a girl standing outside, sucking cold air into my lungs so I can pretend to smoke a cigarette. I hold my breath, then let it go. Slowly, in puffs, I try to tongue into rings. I love this proof of myself more than any other, for I am at an age where I hate my image in photographs. I hate the sight of my face in the mirror. I hate the sound of my name in the mouths of others. With darkness swarming down through the trees, I am in that moment both present and vanishing. And then I write that landscape and its history and how we lived near a bombing range during the Vietnam War. And so all night long we could listen to the bombs, which was very weird because my brother had to run away, as my sister did as well. So I tell that story and how I got a horse out of fire and blah, blah, blah.
And here's the ending. There's a lot in there. I walk in the woods at night through a storm, my feet feeling for footsteps frozen on the trail. Others have passed here earlier in the day, or perhaps the day before. I'm trying to find my way to the pond, but the snow is falling hard and it is dark, and I kept wandering off the path. The evergreens slumped beneath a foot of new snow are all broad-hipped, all icy hoop skirts and wet bustle. They seem suddenly a new species, life from another galaxy. I imagine living on a planet where it is always night, and the thought of never seeing the sun again fills me with fear. I scramble across a stream bed and then slide my way up the next hill. In the darkness, I wade into a stone wall completely buried in snow. This wall, built by settlers a century and a half ago, has long been abandoned. This division of property, once important enough to warrant all that work, is at best ornamental now. By the time I reach the pond, I am breathless, sweating, so I lay back in the snow, drifting deep along the banks. My body fits so perfectly in the cavern carved by my weight, I feel I am being held. The quiet is exquisite. My pulse pushes against my neck. I push my fingers into it briefly to feel its rhythm, its speed. This is routine for me, this touch testing the heart. The surgeons had told me it was too sensitive. There was too much nerve tissue that had to be burned away, or my heart would just gallop off beyond itself eventually. And so I surrendered to their inquiry. I let them map my heart. I let them target the microscopic sensitivities. I let them burn what I know and feel to be my heart, while I watched what they name my heart become a black knot of panic on a TV screen. My electrophysiologist insinuates he is a religious conservative, telling me in one odd conversation that if all else fails, I might want to contemplate cultivating a closer relationship with God. He wears a frayed blue Velcro bracelet, WWJD. I'm briefly horrified when I notice this. He's holding a football-sized model of a human heart in his hands, flipping the chambers open like cabinets to explain what must be done to the heart in my chest. I'm letting a man of a fanatical God into my heart, I say to myself in shock, wondering what happened to the man of science he must have been once upon a time. Will this surgical deadening of my heart ruin my liberalism, I ask him, joking to ease my nerves. And he laughs, and because he laughs, I tell him there's hope for him still. He thinks he is saved. None of us is saved, I want to tell him, until the whole thing is saved, all of it. And I mean everything, right down to the last liar, the last killer, the last rat. Seven targets, seven burns, seven notches, one for each member of the family, mother, father, brother, sisters, me. Jesus, I scream when my brain climbs up out of the leaden fog they keep injecting in my IV. When I am awake, I watch much of the procedure on television, the image of my heart contracting around the flame created by radio waves. On a computer across the room, the surgeon is hunched, studying the map he has made of my heart. It is three-dimensional, indigo and turquoise and green. It looks like India. It looks like the Chesapeake and its tributaries. Colonizer, healer, he places his sweating hands on my shoulder at some point and says, "You have to stop screaming. You're making me feel bad." After 6 hours of mapping and burning, he leans over my face again, his brow beaded with sweat. For the first time, I notice he's dressed in lead. He tells me he needs to determine if a hole has been inadvertently punched in my heart wall. I may be bleeding into myself, he says. There's only one way to know for sure. He must inject bubbles into my heart and do an echocardiogram at the same time. A bubble echo, he calls it, pushing the champagne into the catheter once the imaging machine is in place. We may have to switch theaters, bring in a team, go at my heart from the outside, or I'll bleed out entirely into myself. I don't want this, really, but I tell him I hope it's happened. He looks at me surprised. I'm a bleeding heart liberal, I explain. For the metaphor to become literal again, this would mean something. Again, he laughs a big laugh, and I laugh a big laugh, and the bubbles pass through the chambers of my heart unseen, and so the test must be done again. The second time, we're silent, watching the screen, and there it is, my hula dancer heart, whole, her black grass skirt pulsing with bubbles. He smiles. In this moment, I feel a kind of pure love for him, the adoration of a daughter, of a dog. A nurse snaps the pink cap off a syringe and shoots morphine into a port embedded in the top of my hand. There's a pinch, a burn, and a buzz begins to circle my brain, dragging a banner reading, "I love you," past my conscious mind over and over again. "I love you. I love you," I imagine saying to the doctor who's long ago vanished. But my jaw has become unhinged by endorphins, and I am dreaming again. Later, wrapped in warm blankets, I watch images float to the surface of the television bolted to the ceiling in my room. There's an image on screen, a night vision camera illuminating darkness. There is payload arcing toward a target, a building in which people are presumed to be sleeping. I close my eyes and open them 100 years later. There is beer being poured, the froth, the fruits of golden plains. The recovery nurse presses his fists against both sides of my pelvis to help seal the incisions in my femoral arteries. I imagine it looks as if he's just finished planting a small tree, pushing loose earth back into itself. He wears a zippered pouch full of drugs around his waist. He is a useful man. He calls me kiddo, asks me my name and the date over and over again, as if he has amnesia. I contemplate causing a disturbance. It is 1492, and my name is Columba. I slur through my opiated face. "Hush," he says. "You can't move for 4 more hours. Stillness is painful, and so I take this order to be punishment for this game I've been playing with time and identity. "Aw, man, I'm just fucking with you," I dream say. "My real name is Motherfucker, and it's motherfucking Miller time." Over his shoulder, on the television, I see images of tanks and flags and flames. Someone is bombing someone else again. And then I'm back in the world again, testing my feeling for it all. I walk out of the hospital into a world of snow and war. I wander through this night alone, far from everyone I have ever loved. I walk in the woods to recover myself, to remember my way back to community. I'm returning to a faith as primitive as molecules. My creed, a recitation of the simple fact that the imperative of the earthly being is to survive. Snow drifts down through bare branches onto my face, the flakes melting when they meet the heat of my flesh. It stings my skin warmly, like a cat's tongue. The snow folds itself over me, its body reminding me of the body of my white cat, how she would stretch herself across my chest in the days after surgery, her heart over my heart, her purring a kind of healing. The snow is falling steadily enough, it would only take a matter of hours before I would completely disappear. Snow drops in clumps from the branches above. Wake up," the cat says, and so I rise and return to my form again, to the whiteness of the page, to attempt again this remembering. Elizabeth Rollins and Ben Johnson had a collaboration that was in the first issue of Trick House, and it's absolutely beautiful. And that's, you can still get that link, can you? Yeah, highly recommend you spend time with it, because I've visited it numerous times, and it's fantastic because it gives you something different every time. Elizabeth Rollins has published in Green Mountain Review, Tarpaulin Sky, the New England Review, GW Review, the Bellevue Literary Review, and the Philadelphia City Paper, among others. She's the author of The Sin Eater, a chapbook, Corvid Press, and she received special mention in the Pushcart Prize Anthology and a New Jersey Prose Fellowship in 2003, and she has just finished a novel titled Origin. Ben Johnson is a painter and photographer who graduated from the Philadelphia Academy of Fine Arts in 2001, and he's currently represented by Artist House Gallery in Philadelphia, the Field Gallery in West Tilbury, Massachusetts, and Accent Gallery in Ocean City, New Jersey. Ben's publications include an upcoming feature in June 2008, of American Art Collector. Well, time's very funky. Chronology is totally an illusion. So this is Elizabeth Rollins and Ben Johnson.